Steve Stending. I don't know about you, Gary. I hope you are.
I would rather hope. Well, why aren't you, Jim? For shame.
My foot got stuck. The Queen is expected to resist dropping the word empire from CBEs and OBEs and MBEs. Reports out of Britain claim she wants to put it off this change until Prince Charles becomes king. Doesn't want it in her lifetime because a campaign is underway there. Supported keenly by the British Labour Party, we believe, to replace empire with excellence in the titles of the honours, because empire is a jingoistic relic of Britain's colonial past. What do you think about that?
Dreadful. Terrible. Absolutely. Well, it is a jingoistic relic of... But, you know, Britain is, and probably will be for at least in my lifetime, a very, very historically bound country. We are culturally extraordinarily conservative.
Yeah, good point.
We do not like to surrender this kind of thing. First of all, if you were to ask your average Brit what OBE, CBE even stands for, a lot of them might not even be aware. And yes, it is a throwback to the days when we still did have the greatest empire ever. Sorry, I'm having a Winston Churchill moment for a second there. But yeah, it's part of our history.
Are you
history.
Still standing?
No, he sat down again.
It was hard to sit down during those, having a moment. But no, I mean, seriously, we like our history. Ours is a country that is absolutely riddled with anachronism, with throwback, and it's what we do.
And a big tourist industry based on that.
Absolutely. Incidentally, just as a quick aside, what the Queen actually said was that she doesn't want these changes to happen while she is still the monarch, which is a very, very ambiguous statement. There could be a veiled reference to a possible abdication in favour of Charles in there, perhaps, if we wish to read the tea leaves.
Well, she probably didn't want to talk about her dying.
Obviously. I mean, she could have said, in my lifetime, but she didn't.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, until one pops one's royal clogs.
Okay, so you think it's a silly idea, dropping empire, do you?
Yeah, but then, unlike certain people around here, I don't actually have a gong.
Order of the British Excellence. Gary, what do you think?
Well, I actually think excellence is crazy. I think empire is so anachronistic now that I remember when I got my gong, I rang somebody who knows what these things are, and I said, it's not a knighthood, is it? And because I couldn't hold my head up in the Irish society with a knighthood. So, but in New Zealand, we've done away with it, apart from that crazy knighthood nonsense that's come back, but we've created our own gongs, and I think they're fine.
Bob Geldof
and
accepted,
I think,
one.
Hmm?
If it's good enough for Bob Geldof,
that was an honorary knighthood. He's not actually.
Well, they could have made Gary an honorary knight.
Well, he Gary's a subject of the crown.
I wrote at the time on his behalf.
Yeah, I'm going to indulge in a very quick rant here. Actually, the entire honours system in Britain, as far as I'm concerned, is highly messed up. Basically, the people who get the honours these days are the people who don't really deserve them. We've just had the Olympics, and you can bet your life that people like Bradley Wiggins will be getting knighthoods for basically tapping into popular emotion. People who actually do serious cultural public service for society tend not to get the same recognition.
And that's not just a British argument. That's a strenuous argument in New Zealand.
I would hope it is here too. I mean, yeah. I am going to basically flog a dead horse here. My dad, for about 30-odd years, was a magistrate, a lay judge in Salford on the juvenile bench. And you have to understand that that's a rough gig. He was dealing with some very, very unpleasant people. And this is an unpaid position, basically. This is a member of society who gives up his time to take part in this. And he did this for 30-odd years. He was chairman of the juvenile bench in Salford. And as I said, it's not an easy gig. Now, we always used to joke that one day my dad was going to get his knighthood. And obviously that was never on the cards. But we always figured there'd be something that ought to be a reward for that. And to be fair, in 2001, here my mother did actually get an invitation to a Buckingham Palace garden party. Okay. And so they were in the same time zone as the Queen briefly. And that was very nice. But then you look at someone like Elton John got a knighthood for singing at Princess Diana's funeral and singing in a particularly execrable song at that. And I don't see why somebody who gives 30 years of service gets a few nice cucumber sandwiches. And yet Elton John, who's already got more money than God, gets the knighthood.
I take your point, but there are these sterling examples, especially in New Zealand and no doubt in Britain too, of people who thoroughly, thoroughly deserve these gongs, who are completely unsung, often except by those in their immediate community who couldn't give a toss about getting them. Yeah, as well. I mean, they don't do it for that.
My dad didn't.
I can remember when I got to the sort of gonging ceremony, I felt a complete fraud because when we listened to what the people who are getting QSMs, Queen's Service Medals, they were the real people. They were the ones that did the community work forever, and they were finally like your dad. And it is a magnificent. I think that's the highest honour, Queen's Service Medal. I think if you aspired to get a QSM, you've really made it.
There are lots of lovely people with QSMs, aren't there?
Oh, amazing! Amazing.
Talking of the word empire, says Mike Somerville. I wonder if you know that around the start of last century, Wellington was often referred to as Empire City. I didn't know that.
That makes sense.
I think it had a great ring to it, better than Windy Wellington. That'd be a title up on the hill.
They should bring it back.
Up on the cutting. Yeah. Empire City.
Yes.
On the panel today, Gary Moore is with Steve McCabe. Steve, what's on your mind now that you've got the airline saga out of you?
Well, I've not. We're going to revisit.
Are you going to talk about this again?
We're going to revisit it. And no, I'm not going to name the airline. All I'll say is that judging by the name of it, you have to wonder, will the planes go all the way? Is all I'm going to tease it with.
What do you mean?
I'll let you figure that out for yourself. But what got me thinking was we were dealing with call centre employees. We were talking to people who answer a phone simply because they're getting paid to. They've got no affiliation really with the company. And I mean, they're nice people. They're great people. The woman that spent a long time on the phone with my missus apparently was extraordinarily helpful and very, very, very good. But the problem that you have these days when you're dealing with companies the size of, for example, an airline, is that it's very, very difficult to actually get to deal with somebody who is in any meaningful way invested in the company that they represent, whether we're talking about a financial investment or any sort of personal investment. We're moving away from smaller businesses where if something goes wrong, the person you're dealing with is personally engaged in making sure it goes right. It's very, very difficult to run a business, in my opinion, where you're not directly involved with your customers. That's why these days when I do run into issues like that, I go to the CEO. The great thing is these days, CEO's email addresses are very, very easy to get hold of. Usually on whatever company's website, you'll find his name or her name, and you'll find their email address. Contact them. These are people who actually care.
Yeah, but the impact of that will start to be blunted as more and more people catch on to contacting the CEO.
Well, quite possibly that will happen eventually, but for the time being, not everyone seems to have latched onto this one yet. So I use this as a fairly blunt force weapon anytime I run into. I've had good results out of this. I had an issue with Vodafone a while back, for example. I emailed Russell Stannards, the CEO of Vodafone. Issue got resolved within 2 days.
Okay.
It works, but you have to do that these days. I started off with that issue, incidentally. I went into the local Vodafone shop in Pukekohe. The woman behind the counter was a brick wall. Couldn't get anywhere with her. Got onto Russell Stannards. 2 days later, the woman behind the counter was handing me a new iPhone. It works.
Steve McCabe and the saga of the airline that doesn't... I can't work that one out. Gary Moore, what have you... well, you went to TEDx.
Yes.
Now, a further question on that, because you mentioned, you know... Ernesto Ciroli and Joshua Iosifo, those lovely young men you heard talk.
Yep.
But in what other ways did you have your eyes opened there?
Well, we were challenged there by an Afro-American speaker to be brave, brave, brave. So I'm going to comment on Christchurch as it is now. It's 2 years at 4:35 tomorrow morning since we had our earthquake. And it's time to reflect on what's happening here. And I believe that the structure set up by the government after the February quake of Sierra is dominated by one man, Jerry Brownlee, and I think it's time for that to be changed. Minister Brownlee has put in place a command and control management regime and has surrounded himself with people that keep orders, and I don't think that's healthy or democratic. And when I look at what's happened recently, that the planning has been mostly top-down, bottom-up planning is slower and has better long-term results. People sit in their homes and businesses frustrated at the battles between EQC and their insurers, and there is a climate of fear for ordinary citizens and worry, particularly those who are vulnerable, have young or are elderly. EQC and Fletcher's appear to be at loggerheads, And how the hell did a supposed private sector government give all the rebuilding responsibility to one company, Fletcher's? Christchurch City Council consulted widely and well regarding the central city, and then the government took this over, and after a rushed 100 days of secret meetings and launched with a champagne celebration led by the Prime Minister, here is what we've made of it. But the following days showed that the government was setting the rules and Christchurch City Council and its citizens were going to have to pay for it, even an unwanted roof on a stadium in a place they didn't push for. And the private sector property owners are now finding that they're having their properties compulsorily purchased by the government and told, have a nice day. These titles will be sold en masse by the government to whom? Westfields? Mall owners? Overseas companies? Property owners need certainty. The current regime is a contraceptive for investment. If you invest and the state can take your property, and that has happened, and this has happened to many investors and creative businesses, they'll just move to the margins where Sarah has no say on developments. And local investors are sitting watching the whole thing going down the gurgler. My personal family, we've invested hundreds of thousands in the central city since the earthquake, and we're not sure that the plan allows room for our business. You know, in the central city projects alone, the fees will be over $100 million. Who's going to challenge the friendly consultants? Some who are in, and the bulk of consultants are out. Who manages the competitions for the ideas? Who manages there's a network running the city, an old boy network, which are they going to carve up our process? There's almost a total absence of women in key roles in Christchurch right now. Is 50% of the population forgotten? Young people aren't engaged, and they're going to be the ones that are paying the rates and running our businesses when we're old. We need change. We need a new structure with a wise board heading Sarah. And this isn't about me being a Labourite. This isn't about National Party or Labour or Greens or New Zealand First or Māori Party. We need Christchurch to grow a spine. It's not about Westminster politics. It's more important than that. Sir Epirana Nata got it right when he said, what is the most important? It is people, it is people, it is people.
The truism, I'm trying to think of something new to ask you because, you know, in terms of what we discussed last time you were on about the announcement of the Christchurch plan, and we went through it a bit. It's the truism said about Napier that, you know, you gave the job for the rebuild, true or not, and it's probably a gross exaggeration, to a bunch of architects and said, you know, create the future city. The point is, you know, you can do it. What are you saying, that the council should have been involved more, that the role of the council in terms of how Christchurch should be has somehow been usurped by this command structure that you're alleging, Gary? Is that what you're saying?
I am indeed. I'm saying that the central government, which doesn't, I mean, none of the political parties really understand central government, and I chose not to go into central government because I don't particularly like Westminster politics, but the central government has taken over ECAN, and it's now taken over the city council, and city council has been turned into a eunuch in Christchurch, and I think it is time that we actually challenge that. And what you know, the first Gerry Brownlee will actually make this quite personal. I know that. I can feel that coming on pretty quickly. This isn't what I'm trying to do is to get proper debate on public policy, and people are feeling scared in Christchurch to actually stand up and say this isn't right. The first thing that happens is you're called a name, or you're called, you know, you're standing for office or whatever. And that's not what's on my agenda. What's on my agenda is we need to say we've got to put a wise board in place that's got good connections into the community, that opens things up for all sorts of people to actually have an opportunity to participate. And business and private people in their homes are scared. EQC's not working properly, and we've actually got to, you know, the public meeting. I attended a public meeting the other night, 500 people there, and the tension amongst people there was palpable. And we've got, you know, the rest of New Zealand says, oh, you know, get on, pull your act together, Christchurch. But in fact, we can't. We've actually, it's hard.
All right.
And
I've got to move on, but I mean, the last time Jerry Brownlee came on the panel talking about this, you know, he would say, not that I'm a spokesperson, but I know what he would say. He'd say, listen, you're looking at the bottle half empty. Look at what's been achieved in Christchurch in a comparatively short space of time. That is the other aspect to it, isn't it?
Yeah, but Jerry Brownlee gave a speech last week. It's all surrounded by, you know, you see the picture of the people there, a whole lot of old men, you know, my age, at listening in adoring, with adoring looks on their face to the minister. We've got to get out there and engage with the ordinary people, and they are hurting, and so are businesses. And I, you know, I speak as both a person that's engaged out in the community and engaged in business, and it isn't all about the middle, and it isn't all about the perspective that Jerry Brownlee and his team have got, and we need to broaden it.
All right. We're going to talk about Tony Marriott in just a tick, and we'll do that with Andrew Scott Howman. Just before we go there, just to change the topic at 5:09, what do you think about this? Just your quick thoughts. The Auckland Council's dropped its bid to recover more than $30,000 in costs to clean up after a notorious tagger, Mr. Benjamin Stewart, who's filed for a form of bankruptcy. But before he did so, he was claiming his obsessive-compulsive disorder was to blame. In September 2009, he pleaded guilty to 21 charges of causing intentional damage by spray painting graffiti. Now, what do you think is the appropriate punishment for a tagger?
Well, first of all, can I ask, if he's claiming he's got some sort of psychiatric disorder that causes him to do this, what therapy has he sought for it?
Pass. I do not know.
No, I think he's milking that one. Well, the obvious thing, the obvious penalty would be, to begin with, community service, have him clean up the damn stuff.
Hear, hear.
We deal with tagging at my school all the time. It is an absolute scourge. I am sick of it. It shows utter contempt for your surroundings and for other people's belongings. And I think him trying to use some cop-out excuse about OCD is a joke. What he should do is, if he's pleaded guilty, presumably he's accepting responsibility for what he's done, put the rubber gloves on, get some spray stuff, go and clean off the mess he's made.
All right, so you sentence him to community work, cleaning off tags.
Yep. Well, yeah, his own and others.
Okay.
Yep.
Christchurch City Council CEO Tony Marriott's ratepayer-funded legal action against city councillors has been described by an employment lawyer as extraordinary behaviour. It emerged last week that Tony Marriott had filed a personal grievance against city councillors in April, which relates to a protest outside the civic headquarters in February against his controversial $68,000 pay rise. And six of the then 13 city councillors attended the protest, which called on the government to dismiss Mr. Marriott. Well, before Andrew Scott Howman comes on, Gary, obviously you first again. Does it seem odd to you that someone in his position would file such a grievance while remaining in his role as Christchurch CEO?
I think it's utterly outrageous for Tony Marriott to take a personal grievance for councillors attending a protest. That is absolutely normal behaviour, political behaviour. We've all done it. And I think that... to me, the key issue here is that Bob Parker should not have let this get to this position. As a leader, his job is to make sure that Tony Marriott doesn't do this. And it's also his job to make sure that he is working effectively with the councillors to make sure it doesn't happen either. And to me, it's a total failure of leadership by both Tony and Bob. And if this had happened in my time, I'd be working very closely with the CEO to actually manage him out of the position, because it's obvious that the relationships have broken down to the point it's not manageable, and that's, you can't have that. It's too important, particularly in Christchurch at the moment. It's a tragedy, and I'm really sorry it happened.
Just before Andrew, your quick comment.
Somewhere between farcical and bizarre, really, isn't it? I mean, basically, he's got his $68,000 a year pay rise. A few people have said they don't agree with it, and he's thrown a wobbly over it. That's not mature behaviour.
Andrew Scott Howman is a Wellington barrister, Port Nicholson Chambers, specialising in employment law. I think Andrew's spoken to us before about the special situation of councillors as employees and such. Andrew Scott-Howman, good afternoon.
How are you, Jim?
Very well, thank you. Did this grievance cause you to scratch your head?
Well, maybe not scratch my head, but I certainly can add some perspective to what the panel has already said by giving you, as always, the legal take, which sometimes makes all of us scratch our heads, I guess. Yes. For most of us in life, we have one boss. This is an identifiable person that we report to and who's largely responsible for our well-being as an employee. And even if we work for a corporate, you know, if you work for a large organisation, most often there's a line manager, one person who is responsible explicitly for looking after an employee's needs and so forth. The situation is slightly different when you're the chief executive or managing director of an organisation. And that's because inherently you report to a collective. It's normally a board of directors or, in this case, a council. And the first thing that makes that unusual is instead of just going to one person and working out whether or not you get a pay rise or working out whether or not your performance is up to scratch, effectively you are submitting to a democracy. And that's the first odd thing, that it may not necessarily be that all the people on that board of directors, or in this case the council, agree with what is decided, but they have to go with the democracy. So that's the first odd thing. But the second strange thing, from an employment law perspective, is in this case, of course, the boss, if you like, the council, is inherently a political animal. And unashamedly so, because councillors are elected or voted out on the position that they take in relation to such things as council spending. So you've got a rather unusual situation where an employee reports to the council, and the council is in itself a body of individuals, some of whom don't necessarily agree with where the majority vote goes on such things as a pay rise. Now, I don't know the exact circumstances of Mr. Marriott's situation, but what I can comment on is it's a very strange thing indeed, where the boss is in fact 13 or 14 people, depending on who you count. And some of those people have to have a different view to the majority, and I think, as Gary was saying a moment ago, have almost a responsibility to the ratepayers to air the views that they do in public. Now, query whether an employer should have thick enough skin just to put up with that, or whether it's acceptable for the employer to say, hang on a minute, you're my employer, you're supposed to support me, how dare you say something publicly that's contrary to my interests? And it's, I guess, an illustration of the very strange employment situation that it is that things even got to this point.
Okay, so I think you've said that fairly clearly. Also, do you agree? Well, do you agree with Gary Moore that there is some kind of responsibility between the mayor and the CEO to resolve a grievance like this before it gets to this stage?
Well, I think generally, not just in a council situation, but in any organisation, these are the two most important people. It's the same as the chair of a board and the chief executive. And indeed, there is a responsibility from a point of leadership in any organisation for them to sort their differences out. Having said that, it's quite open for these people to fall back on the law, either the chief executive or the chair, in this case the mayor. But what's interesting, and the perspective I can offer, when this law was drafted in 1999, it was initially suggested that it shouldn't apply to chief executives, partly for this very reason, that it's a very odd law to apply to this very strange situation.
Oh, that's so interesting.
In any respect, it is an extraordinary situation and probably one where the law doesn't fit perfectly.
Okay, before we go, could your employer put the kibosh on your smoko breaks? I've got to ask you this. Critics of this government bill say leaving your desk to stretch your legs, popping out for a bite of lunch, could soon be outlawed. From what you've seen of this, Andrew Scott-Howman, is this a realistic fear?
I don't think it's a realistic fear, but sometimes when I'm an employment advisor, it feels a little bit like being the prince in Cinderella. You've got a shoe and you're trying to find the foot that it fits. The thing about meal breaks is, everyone would agree, it's a great idea for people to have a break during their working day. And for most of us, I'd say the vast majority, it's a really simple thing to work out with your boss when you have a lunch hour, when you go and make a cup of tea, all that sort of thing. But of course, there are exceptional circumstances. For example, flight controllers is a good one, where people just literally can't leave their desk, not without some sort of backup plan being in place.
Yeah.
The problem is the law as it was drafted was perceived by some as being too generous to employees and giving them too much power. The way that it's now drafted, the amendment that's before Parliament, it shifts that balance back a little bit. I don't think it's realistically going to be a problem for most people.
All right, thank you. Andrew Scott-Howman on the panel. Steve McCabe. Appreciate your company.
Always a pleasure.
Drive safely home.
Thank you very much.
If you're going through Remuera. And Gary Moore, thanks. A lot of reaction coming into your comments today, as you can probably expect. Thanks for coming on the panel again, Gary.
Thank you.
The Checkpoint follows, and we are back tomorrow. Thanks, everybody else.